And welcome to another great podcast. I'm Jeff Snyder, founder and CEO of The Morning Pulse, and welcoming you to the Weekly Pulse Sunday. And of course, I'm joined by our great panel of experts. Joining me from Arizona, a great advisor, Mr. George Grombacher.
Hey,
and from hello, George. How are you, my friend?
Great.
I got to work on my intros, of course. But and then joining us from New York, yeah, obviously this is recorded in real time, so everyone knows who's listening in. And also a person who needs an introduction, but no need for an introduction. She joins us from New York City. She's a tech reporter from The Motley Fool, Miss Natalie Walters. Nat, how are you?
Doing great. Thanks for having me again.
Well, great to have you on. George, great to speak with you as well. Lots going on this week. Ups and dips and valleys in terms of the market, obviously. Some new news on retirement legislation and regulatory new rules that we'll hear from later in the day. We've got two great guests this week, one from the Spark Institute, talk about cybersecurity, and then another talking about real estate. So we've got a full program. But I wonder if we could start, George, with you. I know you host your own podcast. What's top of mind for you this week as you kind of talk to clients and also conduct your own podcast?
Well, we had some great guests on the Money Savage show. We had Peter Lazaroff talking about the democratization of financial advisory. He has a company called PlanCorp and Bright Plan. And we talked about sustainable and responsible investing on the show with Mark D'Souza Shields as well. And then finally had Angela Mader on to talk about journaling and the practice of gratitude. So good content. But I tell you what, we're going to talk to Ali Melito here later today, and we're going to talk about how hypersensitive some millennials were about not having enough money saved. And it just sort of reminded me of last week where we were talking about the national anxiety score. So people are, some folks out there are still and will continue to be apprehensive about money, and it just always reinforces the need to take a grounded approach and be mindful of your spending and all that good stuff. So that's some of the stuff that's been on my mind.
Well, that's a great set of guests, great set of topics. I didn't even mention that, you know, we're obviously recording on a Friday. So it's Friday the 18th. But this weekend there's some big events going on. There are three big events. The first, which we'll get to in a minute, the Royal Wedding. The second is the Preakness, and a third is Sunday's the Weekly Pulse Sunday podcast, so people can check out through iTunes or Google Play. But Natalie, the Royal Wedding. I mean, I've been kind of watching this thing kind of build up, and I remember the last couple of weddings, certainly Princess Kate, and then Lady Diana. But this has a special heart in a place in our hearts here in America too.
Yeah, it's definitely. I mean, it's exciting to see Meghan Markle getting her time in the spotlight, and I think we've enjoyed seeing their love story kind of play out. I mean, everyone likes to see a princess love story play out, and I remember watching Kate get married I was just sitting in my living room with my mom, and she was kind of telling me, you know, how special it was watching, like you said, Diane get married. So it's kind of special to share that experience with her. So I'm not sure if I'll wake up at 5 a.m. tomorrow to see this one, but I'll definitely at least watch some clips on YouTube later. But I just saw today that it's estimated to be, I think, about a $45 million wedding. So I feel like it's probably worth it to wake up for it.
Well, wow. Yeah, I mean, that's a lot of money. That's a lot of money. And I know we're going to talk later to Ali Melito, who's going to talk to us about, I guess, normal wedding spending and how to minimize that. But, you know, I think that as Americans, we can be very idealistic. We hold ourselves to the highest ideals, obviously. And, you know, to your point, Natalie, that it really is a special moment. It doesn't happen too often. And, you know, we all often as people hold other people up in high regard. And this is just really neat to kind of check out.
Jeff, the other so you're getting married in October. Is it like $35 million budget, or are you going all the way to 45?
Well, it depends on who you talk to.
Okay.
So I am not in any way royalty. I want to paint. Don't want to paint that picture.
Sure.
Just a guy trying to educate people to save for retirement. So that probably wouldn't, in my mind, wouldn't be a good budget. But my fiance, who's a great person, Jody, has some ideas, and so we have been going through this process to mm-hmm. understand like flowers and the importance of flowers, yeah. but not go over the top. So we are being prudent in terms of a budget. Maybe we should have Jody on at some point. That would be really interesting. I don't know. She could probably do a little bit more explaining, but I think you've got to be prudent because you want to have a great moment. At the same time, you know, we also don't want to put ourselves in the hole for a lot of debt. And I think mm-hmm. if the Royals have $45 million, God bless them, or, you know, that's great for them. And I'll endeavor to try to get up at 5 while I'm doing the morning polls to watch that. But we're not going to spend anywhere remotely close to that. We are going to have a small gathering and just kind of enjoy everyone's time.
Perfect. Perfect.
But Natalie, one thing I wanted to also mention is it is the Preakness, and as a Baltimore kid growing up, I never went to the Preakness, but it was held and is held in Baltimore. But that's a big deal. You know, it's a second leg of the Triple Crown. That's another big moment. Mm-hmm. And, George is our – we're not advocating for this at all because he came back from Vegas. Okay. But he is our quote-unquote gambler, or at least as far as we can tell. The Preakness is this week, and I think a lot of people check that out as well, George. But, you know, people obviously want to be mindful. Don't place those bets. Just watch. Just chill out and, check out what's going on with the horses. Hopefully it'll be a nice day.
Yeah. Well, certainly with the enthusiasm and excitement around cryptocurrency, I don't know how different it is to necessarily betting on a horse. But who knows?
Anyway. Yeah, I agree with that. And, Oliver Rennick's been covering that story for TD Ameritrade Network this week, so we could probably, catch up with him on that as well.
A lot of speculation.
So we went from Royal Reading to Preakness to my wedding. The only thing we didn't talk about was the Avengers movie. I think we'll pass on that. But Natalie, what else is going on in the wonderful world of technology that you could? I'm trying to divert things away from my wedding. So, what's going on in your world?
Yeah, so the tech world, it was a little slower this week. We're coming off of the big earnings weeks from early May, but Google did announce some big news this week. It's releasing a music streaming service called YouTube Music on Tuesday. This is kind of a big deal because YouTube is, by default, the biggest music platform on the internet. You know, people just use it for free, though. So it's interesting to see them kind of watching Apple Music and Spotify rack up these subscribers and think, oh, well, maybe we want that. And if that's what consumers want, then we should do that if we're already the biggest, music streamer, but we're not actually getting subscribers. So it's going to cost $9.99 per month, which is the same price as Apple Music and Spotify. And it'll be ad-free. There will also be a free version that has ads on it that's similar to Spotify. And then they're also going to have a service that offers video and music for $11.99 per month. It'll be called YouTube Premium. And so this is previously what they did is they had a program called YouTube Red. That was, it had video and music, but now this new program is going to let you just opt in for music, if that makes sense. Let me know if that was too confusing, but basically the big news is that now you can just subscribe to YouTube Music for $9.99 per month, and that's going to look very similar to Spotify and Apple Music. So Google's kind of coming in and wanting to take some market share away.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. I mean, I think that when you look at it's all based on the subscribers. I mean, I know you have come on the show and talked about the Amazon Prime, the Netflix growth and their growth in subscribers. It's all about trying to get more subscribers. And then once you have them on your platform, it becomes an opportunity for other, cross sales and other opportunities as well. So I think that's pretty interesting that they're trying to get involved in that, keep up with the Joneses, so to speak, the Amazons, the Apples of the world.
I think it's absolutely fascinating. What I find to be I'm curious about is how in the world artists are actually going to get fairly compensated for having their music streamed across so many different platforms and how they're being compensated for that. I don't think they've gotten their arms around that yet.
No.
Yeah. I think that's part of the reason why music labels are kind of upset with YouTube as they have been doing business in the past, because they weren't getting paid as much from YouTube as they were from Spotify and from Apple Music. So maybe this new app will allow music labels to get more money. And so maybe this is also a way for Google to kind of appease those music labels and keep those partnerships going and those people happy.
Yeah. And if you watch, I forget the name of the documentary on HBO, documenting Dr. Dre and Jimmy Iovine, I mean, this is a central part of that fourth episode. You know, how do you make money in a digital world? Because you're right. I mean, the people who get hurt the most are the artists, because they're creating content. I mean, content is king, but when you commoditize content, you take away the onus to actually create it. And, you know, the same thing's happening in journalism and a lot of other businesses. And I think that's really – the technology is great for reaching people, but it's also can create challenges in terms of people making a living, as you suggest.
Yeah, it's really incredible the amount of content that's for free on YouTube. I looked up some stats beforehand, and the music video This Is America by Childish Gambino, that was released just on May 5th, and it already has 145 million views.
Wow.
And then Despacito, you know, that popular song, hit 5 billion views in April. I mean, it's really incredible. And, you know, you can just play those for free. So I think
– what was the name of that
one? Probably people are just surprised it took so long for – YouTube to do this. That was Despacito.
Oh, okay. I'll have to look.
You missed that one?
Yeah.
Your kids are probably listening.
I'll be 5 billion and then one watches today.
Well, I think this kind of underscores the importance of intellectual property and intellectual property rights that people have. So when you create something, you have a right to that, as long as you've got the legal. You know, you can create something and it becomes yours, and you just have to maintain that property. But I think,
the internet makes everything free.
Well, but it's not really free. I mean, there are, you know, as someone who is responsible for aggregating news, I mean, I can tell you that I have to be careful on images and things like that. So there are, you know, I think the hard part is tracking all that, but you're right. The internet, quote unquote, it's like retirement fees, George. Mm. Everyone thinks that 401k administration is free, right?
Yes.
But it's really not. There's cost to that.
Right.
So, sorry, I went off on my soapbox. Natalie, Instagram, I think, was something else that you wanted to chat about, right?
Yeah, and this is kind of goes with music as well. Instagram's going to start allowing users to tag Spotify songs in their actual stories. And if you don't know, stories is this feature on Instagram where you can put pictures or videos up and they disappear after 24 hours. And what's interesting about this is that Instagram stole this feature essentially from Snapchat. They copied it onto their Instagram, and they've actually copied that feature onto Facebook as well as WhatsApp. So it's kind of interesting because Instagram has been continually updating the feature and adding cool new features, and people are really happy with Instagram stories and say it's addictive and it's exciting and fun. And Snapchat, meanwhile, has kind of been criticized lately for the new redesign. Nobody really liked that. And to make matters worse, Instagram stories already has more than double the users as Snapchat stories.
Oh, wow.
So essentially, Instagram is beating Snap at its own game, and it's kind of sad to watch, but, you know, that's business. Instagram stories is just a better feature already.
Well, George, sounds like we need to expand the podcast to Instagram. Let's work on that over the weekend. Natalie, thank you so much for all your wonderful insight. And if you do get up at 5, good luck with watching tomorrow's royal wedding. I think that'll be fascinating. We'd love to hear your perspective on it next week. And we're certainly looking forward to other top stories that you follow in the week ahead. So thanks for joining us.
Of course. Have a great weekend, guys.
Thanks, Talk Natalie.
Next week.
Bye.
Thanks, Nat.
Bye.
Bye-bye. And that was Natalie Walters of The Motley Fool, kind of giving us her perspective on what's going on in technology. And now we're going to kind of keep with that technology theme, George, and we're going to bring on the executive director of the Spark Institute. And we'll let him tell the audience about the Spark Institute, but we're joined by the executive director, Mr. Tim Rouse. Tim, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Well, thanks for having me, Jeff.
Well, it's always great to catch up with you. And I think George and I obviously know who you are. Many of our listeners may know exactly who you are and what your organization does. But why don't we start there? Could you just, you know, summarize you know, briefly, what is the Spark Institute, and what do you do?
So the Spark Institute is the industry association for the retirement industry record keepers. So our member firms are all of the major record keepers in the industry. And our primary focus is advocacy in Washington, D.C. on regulatory and legislative issues. We have two key conferences a year, one coming up in June. And we also bring together the industry for industry best practices. One of the things that we did was industry best practices around cybersecurity.
Yeah, this is obviously, George, I mean, we have been talking about data breaches. I think everyone on this call is very familiar with Equifax. There's been other data breaches in healthcare. We've been very lucky, Tim, in our space, in the retirement space, regarding data breaches. And it's nice to see Spark has been very vital in being ahead of the curve, if you will, in a lot of ways. The first is with the RFP template that it created many years ago, with the data sharing with 403B plans. And now it's really taking a lead on cybersecurity. And I think that's really amazing. So how are you guys doing that? And can you give us a little behind the scenes and what, you know, some of the key findings are from tackling this huge challenge?
Sure. It's been really a couple year effort. We started this group about a year and a half ago, and its purpose was that we saw this real proliferation of questions coming from both plans as well as prospects. But not only the number of questions, which is completely understandable, but the intimacy of the questions that we were getting. Many of my member firms said, we really don't feel comfortable answering these questions because if we do, the information gets out there, and it's really about how we are going about protecting our clients' data. So we need to come up with some sort of solution. And what we did was we formed our Data Security Oversight Board. And that Data Security Oversight Board was made up of two elements. One element was the plan consultant community, and the other was my record-keeping members. And the plan consultants were really there to make sure that whatever we came up with really met the needs of the clients and the prospects. So we set about, and what we realized is what we needed to do was we needed to create common communication standards. And so we looked at various security frameworks, and what we decided on was to keep that part of it flexible, because many firms use different frameworks for different reasons. And it's actually good to have a diversity of security frameworks so that the bad guys don't have just one code to crack. So once we did that, we ended up taking all of the questions that clients and prospects were routinely asking, and we began to, it turned out that there were something like almost 1,500 questions. And we painstakingly took each question and said, well, what is it that they're really trying to get to with this question? So for instance, if a question dealt with cloud security, we put it in a category of its own. If it had to do with physical plant security, we put it into its own box. And when we were all done sorting out all the questions, we came up with 16 categories. And those 16 categories are what our cybersecurity best practices are built upon. Now, the next step was then, well, how do we get assurance that these 16 categories are being properly addressed? And the way we did that was we realized that the only people that are really allowed in the building, so to speak, would be the auditors that are currently in there. And so we built the whole best practices around third-party attestations, that we will have an independent third party validate what controls are in place for each of the 16 categories, how they were tested, and then what the test results. And then that report is then given to the client or the prospect. And it's a step up from where we are today, because today those questions are all answered by the record keepers themselves. So now you have an independent third party answering these questions and validating exactly what's being done behind the scenes on their behalf.
Well, that is a massive amount of work, 1,500 or so down to 16 and down to a deliverable product. About how long did that take?
It was a year. We just released it in September, so okay. It was a almost a full 2 years.
Wow. And then how do you stay on top of everything changing?
So this group is an ongoing body.
Okay.
And their job is to continually refine and update those standards. One of the things that we're looking at now is definitions. You know, what is a breach? What does it really definitionally mean? It's one of the things that they're looking at. We're also looking at things like penetration testing and how do we best communicate that information out. Yeah, so this is an ongoing organization.
Yeah, I think what's interesting is this technology, this issue has seeped in everywhere. And rightfully so. But this isn't the only issue that your members deal with, Tim. I mean, you still got the other retirement issues, right? I mean, you've got legislation, regulation, the e-delivery of statements. I mean, all these things that consume our world, you're dealing with all your members, which are all the major record keepers and consultants in the space.
Oh, absolutely. On a regular basis. In fact, we have another group that's different from our Data Security Oversight Board, and it's a group that focuses in on – it's made up of the heads of operations for all of our member firms. And they're looking at similar types of issues. They're now looking at issues like increases in fraud attempts because of things like the Equifax breach, where now that personally identifiable information has been compromised and is now out in the on the internet and available. How do you then, what do you need to do to prevent people from calling, using that data, and trying to defraud the accounts? They're also looking at things like missing participants. So we're looking at we're covering really the whole landscape of retirement issues on behalf of our members.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And let's be clear. I mean, there's a lot of work being done here, but it's up to individuals as well to be vigilant, meaning update their addresses if they change employers. You have some responsibility as an individual on maintaining your privacy as well. You've got to, do your part to protect yourselves from phishing scams and things like that. So I think we've all got to be a lot more vigilant, both the employers, the record keepers, and of course, individuals to protect our data. Part of the world that we live in. We can't just all rely on. I mean, I think it's amazing work that y'all are doing at Spark and within the consultant community and the record keepers. But it takes multiple parties to kind of be successful. So hopefully, people can do that. Kind of wrapping up, Tim. I know you also do a lot of education of your members and your membership. You have your annual forums, and there's one coming up in June. Can you talk a little bit about that, just so people know what's going on?
Sure. So June 14th and 15th is our Spark National Conference, and we actually have different tracks. One track that's along the cybersecurity lines is we are two couple things. We just established a new organization in concert with FSISAC, which is an organization that was formulated by the federal government to help various industries. We've created the Retirement Industry Council, which is made up of our members, and it allows our members to share information about cybersecurity risks, bad IP addresses, trends that they are seeing, in a confidential way. And so we're kicking that off at our conference. We also have a session with a special agent from the FBI to talk about cybersecurity and fraud trends. We have another session on biometrics, looking at some of the latest technologies that are being used to help prevent fraud, whether it's through a phone group or other means. And then we also are looking at the overall trends around cybersecurity and what can be done to help mitigate those risks.
Well, it certainly sounds like it's going to be a fun for us retirement nerds. It's a really exciting conference. I know I'm looking forward to attending in June. And people, if they want additional information, they can go to your website, which is www.sparkinstitute.org. That's S-P-A-R-K, right. Institute.org. And they can check it out. So, Tim, thank you so much for joining us on the show. And
thanks, Tim.
We look forward to having you back in a future episode to kind of catch up, see how things are going with cybersecurity and some of the other issues that you're wrestling with around retirement. So thank you and have a great weekend.
You too. Thank you, Jeff. Thank you, George. Take care.
All right, bye-bye. Thanks.
Welcome back, everyone. That was Tim Rouse with the Spark Institute, helping us understand how the industry is combating cyber threats and cybersecurity and all that good stuff. So they're doing great work. And joining us now is Alessandra Melito, the personal finance reporter with MarketWatch. One of our favorite recurring guests. How are you, Allie?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing good. So this week, you made Twitter very, very angry. Tell us about that.
Come on, Allie, tell us.
Yeah, so I wrote the story. It was like a year ago, actually. So it wasn't a news story, but it was shared on Twitter by the MarketWatch handle, and it was about how to save or what you should have in savings for retirement in your 30s. And strategies to get going if you haven't gotten there. So it was shared, and all Twitter went bananas. The thing that made them the most mad was it was a figure that I had found in a study from Fidelity saying that by 35 you should have twice your salary in savings for retirement. And everyone went crazy. They were like, this is impossible. This is unrealistic. This could never work. We have student debt, low income. We have rent that's constantly rising and all this stuff. And I understand where they're all coming from. But the original story actually said that this was not possible for a lot of people. So this is what you should do instead. And that's where we were. Thousands of people were commenting on it.
Wow. Well, at least you got a story. I mean, that's every reporter's dream, right? I mean, you get a story that gets picked up and you get momentum. And maybe this, you know, why quote unquote shoot the messenger? I don't know if I can still use that analogy, but why shoot the messenger? I mean, the message is.
Well, that's the way Twitter works, Jeff.
Yeah. Well, I know. I mean, I tweet once a day. But, I mean, it's like they shame you into, okay, so did you do a mea culpa? I mean, because you're basically right on point, or not you, but the article is right on point.
What I did was, I didn't respond to everybody because there were some people who were very angry and some people who just seemed upset. So I responded to the people who seemed upset, and I just said, you know, you got this. This is a figure just for guidance. If you want to talk about your perspective, let me know. And I talked to some people about why they were so upset with the story. And I did a follow-up this week talking, the title is, if you want to make millennials mad, talk about saving for retirement. And I just said basically that it is a tough situation. You know, millennials especially, they have so much student debt. The average grad, I think, comes up with like 30-something thousand in student debt. And, you know, they are paying for other responsibilities, but retirement just has to be a priority, even if it's a very small one for right now, as you're figuring out other things like getting married or having kids or whatever, you still have to think about it because I am a millennial, we are on the hook. So that's it. Like, we just have to think about it in the backs of our minds when we are making financial decisions. So
people were
on my side, but
yeah, I mean, I think it's tough when people can anonymously attack somebody, or, you know, it's one thing to attack the argument or the what you're proposing. It's another thing to, you know, come after people personally. But I would say, go ahead.
For the most part, nobody really attacked me personally. I mean, I got roped into some of the tweets, you know, saying like, do you know real people?
Nice. Like, yes. Nice.
But they didn't really attack me. It was more like what I was actually happy about was I seemed to have sparked a conversation, because like on Twitter and the comment section of the article, on Facebook, a lot of people were just talking about what's realistic and what's not realistic. And, mm-hmm. you know, they were coming from all sides of the spectrum, so that was nice to see.
There's immense value in having people start to talk about this, particularly if they've not necessarily really ever thought about it. They're just going through the motions in the day-to-day. So, but the next step is obviously then taking a little bit of action, and hopefully it is a bit of a wake-up call. It says, geez, I'm behind. And it's okay to feel upset about that, but what's not okay is just not doing anything about it.
Yeah.
So get upset about it.
I reached out to Fidelity, because Fidelity had come up with that figure. They had calculated that. And I reached out to them after the story went crazy, and I said, this figure of yours has the internet going nuts. Can we talk about it? And they said basically the same thing. They said that the number was meant as guidance. Obviously, not everybody can have twice their salary in savings for retirement, but what they should do is just, you know, think about it and start, because, you know, if you haven't started in your 30s, you still have time before retirement, but you don't want to get to your 60s and then realize, like, oh, I don't have enough. And what do you do then? You know, are you going to work throughout all of the time that's supposed to be meant for your retirement, or are you going to even be able to work? Because some people, unfortunately, they get sick and they're not able to work like they used to. So it's better to be, you know, getting started now than in 20, 30 years.
Allie, can we link to your article when we post the show this coming Sunday?
Yeah, sure. There's two. I can send you the follow-up. This is a little more recent, and it mentions the...
Okay. Yeah, I think that'd be great. I mean, the whole purpose of our show is to have a conversation. You seem to have started that. And let me just say outright that it's not just a millennial issue. I mean, yes, they are the, I guess, newer generation, but my generation, George's, and my generation, Generation X, I think we've got some apathy as well. I mean, I think when you cut across every generation, there are challenges of people saving money. They're either consuming too much, they have too much debt, they haven't really thought about it. We've got to change that. You know, you can have the auto enrollments of the world and all the plan design features, but you've got to get people taking part and taking action, as George said. So I don't just believe it's one generation. They're just one of many groups of people that need to be educated.
Wrong. It's all millennials' fault.
Okay. Well, that's all hate mail. Please send it to George Grumbacher, care of georgegrumbacher.com.
By all means.
Allie, you know, we've got the Royal Wedding. We just talked about it at the top of the show with Natalie. The Royal Wedding's coming up this weekend. I think you all have some maybe some wedding tips that maybe I need to. We talked about my wedding. Somehow George got that injected into the conversation. But you may have some wedding tips. Yeah, very skillful. Wedding tips for me that I can pass along to my lovely fiance to help us manage our budget.
Sure. So my colleague Leslie wrote this article about the royal wedding. So they're doing something a little untraditional. They're having some of their guests bring their own food. From my understanding, it's the people who will be on the lawn to, just to be a part of the celebration, but maybe not be as close to the bride and groom as others. They're going to be bringing their own, like, picnic lunches and things like that. So that's fun. If you do want to feed your guests, however, other ways to save for your wedding include having a winter wedding. The time to get married, or like the busy season for weddings, they're usually the end of May, I believe, to September, the end of September. So once you hit, I think, mid-October, definitely November to March, that's when you have you can get some deals. Also, not having such an elaborate cake is one option. Maybe going for a cake that's two tiers, or a sheet cake instead of one of those huge, like, five-tiered cakes that have, like, you know, that fit the size of a table, which are nice. Not saying they're not, but if you want to do something smaller, that works too. And in-season flowers. So flowers are a huge expense for weddings. And if you can do... if you could pick a flower that is actually in season when you're getting married, you can save money, because otherwise they have to find these flowers from other sources, and that can run into a lot.
Wow, I'm writing this all down, and I'll have to bring Jody on the show. I'm sure she will not come on, but the other thing you left off, I thought
right
maybe
now.
Yeah, please don't. She will yell at me. I will never. Well, she probably won't marry me. You could also have a podcast wedding. Have you ever tried that? You could do a podcast wedding and just bring everybody in on Skype like we're doing on the show. and just get married. You can do it in 5 minutes.
We could have you and Jody get married right here on the Weekly Pulse.
Yeah, I don't know about
podcast
that.
Podcast history.
All right, as I digress. Heavy, and no cake. Well, great.
Great, thank you.
Thanks, Allie.
All right, have a nice week.
All right, bye-bye.
Well, that was a great conversation with Allie Melito, and I think I got some good wedding tips there, George. I'll have to relay those to Jody. So I'll have an update
sure
next
she'll
week.
Be grateful.
But, yeah, I'm sure she'll be real grateful. Maybe we can get her to come on. But we've got a great conversation coming up. We had a couple weeks ago a conversation about real estate, and joining us now is the Executive Vice President of Research and Investor Outreach at the National Association of Real Estate Investor Trusts, Mr. John Wirth. John, how are you, bud?
I'm great. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thanks for coming on. And, you know, we're excited. You know, we talked, George and I talked real estate a couple weeks ago with another industry association, but it was more public and private direct real estate. And I think, you know, what your organization does in terms of tracking REITs and real estate around the country, we thought it'd be great for you to help us further understand, help us and our audience further understand what's kind of going on in the real estate market, and then specifically how REITs are being utilized. So why don't we start there? What, I guess first, for those who may not know, could you just quickly describe what a REIT is? I think I know what it is, and George may know what it is, but there may be some people on the line that don't necessarily know what it is.
Absolutely. It's a great question. And when people ask me what I do, I often introduce myself by saying, you know, I work for the REIT Trade Association. You own REITs, you just don't know it. Because REITs are pretty ubiquitous because there are a number of REITs in the S&P 500. So people have more exposure to REITs than I think they often understand. And what REITs are, they are a corporation like any other, with one twist, which is that they own and operate typically commercial real estate. And part of being a REIT is a requirement that you pay out 90% of your taxable income as dividends. REITs typically pay out all their taxable income as dividends. And so what that provides is a nice steady stream of income to the investor. So it's a way for everyday investors to gain exposure to the broad commercial real estate market as simply as buying a stock.
Well, great. Thank you. Thank you for that very quick definition. You know, George and I are both advisors, consultants during the day, I guess, but we're doing the show during the day, but we're also radio announcers apparently. But REITs can be and are used in retirement programs. So they are used in, 401k plans, 403b plans, governmental 457s, all over the place today, correct?
Absolutely. So REITs are the dominant form of real estate exposure in DC plans and in IRAs. So for example, we estimate that there's more than 250,000 DC plans that have a standalone REIT option. More importantly, given where investment trends are going, REITs are in more than 97% of target date funds, with about 60% of those having a standalone REIT sleeve. So the people are getting their REIT allocations, and typically they're getting it through through their target date fund or through a broad-based mutual fund.
Got it. So what is top of mind for you and your organization right now? What are you working on?
Well, we have our broad-based goals, and then we can talk about where the real estate and REIT markets are. I'll just tell you briefly, our broad-based goals is to encourage the use of REITs and to encourage the use of more real estate exposure among nearly all investors. So just to back up and give you some context, commercial real estate, if you think about it as a share of the investable universe in the United States, it's about 17%. We estimate that the value of commercial real estate outstanding is north of $14 trillion in the U.S. So if you think about sort of the fundamentals of portfolio design, in general, you're going to want to hold assets pretty much in proportion to their share of the market basket. So that would suggest that you would see people holding up to 20% of their assets in their investable assets in commercial real estate. What we typically see are numbers much lower in the DC and IRA world. Defined benefit pension plans, by contrast, they often hold 8 to 10% of their assets in real estate. Whereas what we're seeing in the DC world is numbers more akin to their market weight in a broad-based equity portfolio, more around 3 to 4%. So part of our goal is to try to tell the story of why you need commercial real estate exposure in a portfolio, the substantial diversification and income and capital appreciation benefits that provides, and how REITs can help provide that exposure in a portfolio. That's really our sort of macro message, and it's one that we've been telling pretty consistently for more than a decade.
Well, John, thanks so much for that. So when you look out on the commercial real estate market, how do you put in perspective what's happened over the last quarter and the last year? How do you take performance and kind of bake that into the conversations you're having out there with managers, clients? What's that story sound like?
Yeah, the question, we're getting three broad questions when it comes to talking about where we are in terms of the market cycle. The first question we get is, are we early, mid, or late cycle? The second question we get is, what's the impact of interest rates going to be? And then typically there's some discussion or concern about what's going on in retail. And just to walk you through those, where we feel we are in terms of the real estate cycle, there's a lot of discussion about us being late cycle. If you listen to real estate folks, they tend to use a baseball analogy. And I will tell you that based on that baseball analogy, we have been in a very, very long seventh inning. Because people have been saying we're in the seventh inning for about 4 years now. And we actually, when we look at the market, we're feeling like this has been a long, steady expansion in terms of real estate. But the old cliche is that expansions don't die of old age. And we don't see anything substantially out of balance. We're not seeing excesses on the supply side, which is typically the trigger to the end of a real estate cycle. So we feel like we're firmly in the middle innings, and that this real estate expansion can go on for some time. Obviously, the rate of increase in rents has slowed. But overall, we see the market being in a very stable position right now.
I think one of the things we often talk about on the show. So I mean, you're raising some really good points. And when employers, people who have retirement plans or big pools, asset pools, are thinking about new asset classes, they really need to think about all the angles or all the aspects of it. I think you're talking about that in your comments about, you know, doing the due diligence, understanding, for example, where we are in the cycle, the economic cycle, what are rents expected to do. I mean, that's how you really make a good investment decision. I mean, it's a thoughtful approach. It's sitting down with the committee, the trustees, getting them to understand the asset class, what it means, how it functions, what are the fees. All those things are really important to contemplate when making a decision. It's not just a pure return conversation. It's more about, okay, is this asset class, is it appropriate? What is it about? So what's the story there? I think you've done a lot of that. And then how can this fit into the portfolio, either the portfolio of mutual funds or funds that are being offered, or the actual portfolio if it means an asset pool. And that is a contemplative process I think you really have hit on in your comments.
I think that's exactly right. And I think, you know, there's always this risk of trying to time the market too precisely. There's certainly plan sponsors that we've talked to who, you know, we they at one point they were afraid of the market, then the market was too rich, and then they're worried because the market's undervalued. And the point, the ultimate point is, had they gotten in at the beginning, they would have been enjoying the benefits over the long term. Because it's important to keep in mind, you know, when you're in the DC space, you are a long-term investor, and hopefully your employees are long-term investors. And that's really where I think real estate shows its strength, is in those long-term returns, and more importantly than just the returns, or equally importantly, is really the diversification benefits. One of the things you see with real estate that's very unique is that when you look at correlations between real estate and broader market indices, sort of like the Dow or S&P 500, what you see is that when you look at that over longer and longer time frames, the correlation goes down. With most, if you look at sectors within the S&P 500, what you see is that when you look over correlations over longer time periods, the correlation goes up. So if you're looking for diversification for a long-term investor, investing across different sectors doesn't get you much. Real estate, those diversification benefits actually become more powerful as you look over out over longer and longer periods, because it's over those long periods that the differences between the real estate cycle and broader economic cycles manifest themselves. So that the power, I think, of real estate in a portfolio is really one that is very well suited and really comes to bear for the long-term investor, which is why I think there's such a great fit in DC plans and in target date funds, because those are almost by definition long-term investors.
Well, you're certainly speaking music to our ears, John, in terms of being long-term investors. I mean, we couldn't be, you know, you're kind of preaching to the choir here. So we thank you so much for coming on. We wish you had a lot more time, but maybe you would entertain coming back on a regular basis and kind of giving an update on the REIT marketplace and the real estate market. We'd love to have you back.
Happy to do it anytime.
Great. Well, thank you, Mr. John Wirth with the National Association of Real Estate Investment Trusts. Thanks, John.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome back, everyone. That was John Wirth with the National Association of Real Estate Investment Trusts, filling us in about the current state of REITs inside of retirement plans and where the opportunities might be. Joining us now is one of our favorites. Super excited for the royal wedding tomorrow, Oliver Rennick with TD Ameritrade. Over under on the length of time that it's going to take to complete the nuptials, I say 45 minutes.
Boy, I don't even know. Honestly, I don't know if I've ever watched a royal wedding.
I pulled that
I think
right
it's
going to
be a little bit longer than that. I think
sure,
it's going to be longer
scene.
Than that. Yeah. Well, that's
The only weddings I regularly watch are those on Game of Thrones, and I hope this one goes better. That's all I'm saying.
Well, this one costs a lot of money, according to I think it was Natalie Walters from Tech Reporter from Motley Fool. I think it's like $45 million. So it better be good. Better be good.
The Crown is in debt to the Lannisters, but hopefully they pull it off. Or rather, I think it's the reverse. The Lannisters are in debt. Nah. So what's going on, guys? Should we talk some stocks?
Let's talk some stocks, man.
What's going on?
This is a, you know, when we talk about this every week, it's kind of been a market that hasn't really gone a whole lot of direction for many, that is starting to take shape a little bit. I think the resilience in stocks continues to be surprising to many. We quickly are getting out of the volatile and really just super, super bearish type of news flow that we were getting really from February to April. I mean, we talked about this here. Anytime a market corrects in this bull market, the bears come out of the woodwork, and this time around they had a lot of ammo, which was some passive funds blowing up and concerns about interest rates and the entire cycle finally coming to a close and the QE backstop being gone and all that type of stuff that fits into the thesis. But right now that is quieted down a bit. I mean, the move the past couple of weeks that has been the most impressive to me is just the suppression of volatility. VIX continues to drop, and you might expect that since the market is showing some strength, but just the degree to which volatility has fallen is really surprising to many. Who knows where it will go, but right now there is an overall comfortability with the market, and it shows up in a lot of different places, and it shows doesn't show up in others. I mean, it's a tough week again for staples, a solid week for some other items like energy, and it's just I think that's the story of the market right now is picking and choosing on a sort of week-to-week basis what wins and what doesn't.
Got it. And certainly cryptocurrency and Bitcoin has been in the news, and I think that we've talked about it for off and on here on the show. And
yeah,
do you think that there's a reasonable way to look at cryptocurrency without getting excited about it or without beating up on it too much?
Yeah, I think there is, believe it or not. It's funny you should mention this because this was another week when it was really gave people an opportunity to see who has a sound mind in this market and who doesn't. The bottom line is there's a difference between being genuinely interested in this new technology and the concept of a digital currency or asset and being someone who is basically taking advantage of fervor and contributing to the problem. What I see right now is sort of a transition period that's happening, and I think we got a taste of this on our NASDAQ show that we did on Monday. We were in New York, and this month's show overlapped with the big cryptocurrency conference, Consensus. We had a lot of really smart guests on that were telling me about the market. Corey Johnson from Ripple, the chief market strategist and a former colleague of mine at Bloomberg, talked to me about their company and the difference between their company and the digital asset, the XRP. We had Andrew Keys on from Consensus, a firm that basically works with developers to come up with products and companies utilizing primarily Ethereum as a blockchain, and also Vinny Lingamon, who is an entrepreneur who's trying to tackle security issues via this technology. So the idea that this technology is exciting is, I think, indisputable. I think that you have to recognize, and I wrote a post on LinkedIn about this, the sort of if nothing else, this is going to give us a great opportunity for people to filter who they listen to and how they sort of interpret market finance news, because there are tons of people out here that continue to just say ridiculous things about Bitcoin, mostly on the bullish side, but some bears too. I mean, one could easily wager that Jamie Dimon's saying that, you know, it's total fraud and, you know, or that it's rat poison from Buffett. Look, those are probably a little bit outlandish too, just given how many people are genuinely interested in it and the technology behind it. But right now, there's still so much froth and just BS that comes from people making projections about what the price is going to do. It's impossible to know, and it's impossible to value. So there is definitely a lot of froth in this market, and as much as many of these people want to move past this speculative frenzy on the asset side and the trading side into a disruptive technology, I do believe there are people that really want that to happen. But as long as you have individuals frothing up the market and making ridiculous calls and getting people excited about bogus ICOs and tokens and all this stuff, then it's going to be working against itself. So what you're going to see over time is that separation happen, but I don't see it really happening yet because more and more of this market has become concentrated outside of the top 10 currencies. Bitcoin is now like 37% of the market, which is close to the record low. The idea that people are now figuring out the safer places to be is just not the case. Many signs still point to individuals chasing big gains, and that's kind of where we are right now.
Well, you certainly can't fault people for that after it returns whatever it returned. And
yeah, there's nothing wrong with, wanting to make some money. It's just the people that then go out and basically lie and say they know what's going to happen. They don't. So
well,
you know.
At least you're not bothered by that.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that in our last segment, Oliver, which you did not hear, we were talking about long-term investing, and now here we're like on the other side of the
– But here's the thing is that the joke is there are now people saying that you need to put in your RIA. So,
yes.
You know, beware the charlatans is basically the nature of what I wrote.
Yeah.
I actually did read that post.
Yes.
It was excellent. I think I liked it. one of the.
I appreciate that, Jeff.
Absolutely.
Thinking and feeling are different things, and I think that people need to put their thinking caps on when they're talking about this new technology, as opposed to just how they feel about it. So.
Exactly. There's no reason why you can't have some of the same principles of analysis and sound reason. I mean, there are people saying that this market was going to rally because of a conference, because it happened the past two conferences or three conferences or whatever. It's like, all right, man, there's no statistical grounding to that whatsoever. The market participation has vastly changed. So we can go on and on, but beware the charlatans. Thanks for the like, Jeff.
Yeah, no problem. So you wrapped up a trip in New York. Are you making any other road trips? You're going to go out to Silicon Valley? Are you going to do the show from any other locations?
You know, I might have to pitch that, but now that it's pretty warm out, the East Coast is not a bad place to be. We are doing the next show June, about a month from today when we're recording this, on June 18th. We'll be our next NASDAQ show, and we'll be there every month. So it's really exciting. It's a really great partnership, and we're really happy to be there. And it's been very fun being able to kind of go back and forth between my sort of new city here and the way markets operate, and also being in New York, where frankly that's still is the center of the finance world. So it's good to have a presence there.
And then I was going to ask you lastly. In terms of like guests, and you made the comment about, quote unquote charlatans. I mean, how do you, there's a lot of information that's out there, and you've had a lot, you've been in this quote unquote game for a long period of time. How do you cut through the clutter? I mean, you're following this stuff. You're an analyst yourself, but how do you cut through the clutter of some of the noise that's out there?
I think it's about conviction, to be honest. I hate to kind of make this comparison, but it's almost sort of like the partisanship that has been, I think, a part of our, social media kind of culture, where there's a lot of shouting that goes on. There's a lot of not listening to the other side. And the same thing happens in financial markets when, there is even more room for subjectivity. There really is a lot in terms of, you never know what stock is going to go up. You can make educated guesses, some more educated than others, but generally if someone says something is certain, then they're probably full of it. And then it's about looking at just why. Okay, well, if you think something's going to do this, why? I mean, that's essentially what we do every day on the network. That's what our sort of mission is, to ask hard analytical questions. If somebody comes on and they're a bear, I'm going to try and poke holes in the bear case, because that is what people deserve that are watching. If somebody's a bull on the same asset, I'm going to do the opposite. So if you're following someone, they say, oh, this is definitely going to happen, ask why. And when you get the answer for why, look at that more in depth. So, the most clear example from this week was that call that this conference was going to send the price of Bitcoin skyrocketing. But yes, it could have. Sure, it could have. It didn't. It's nothing to do with being bearish or bullish of the technology or anything like that. It's just about saying beware of certainty in terms of projections, especially when they're based on very little. You have so little history in this market that there's very little to draw on to make those sort of projections. You don't have a historical basis. You don't have a historical grounding apart from, 3-4 years. But within that time, the market's totally changed. So it's tough, I would say avoid people who are 100% certain about things.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I'm going to go on a limb and tell you that I really have no idea what's going to happen with cryptocurrency next.
and neither do the experts, George.
So I guess that makes me an expert. Anyway, Oliver Rennick, thank you, sir. Well done again.
Thanks, guys.
Have an awesome weekend. We'll catch up next week.
Thank you, gentlemen. Have a good one.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Welcome back. Another fun segment with TD Ameritrade Network's Oliver Rennick, talking about all things market and getting into a little bit of cryptocurrency. Joining us now is one of the dynamic duo on the Hill, Mr. Kevin Walsh from Groom Law Group. Kevin, how are you?
Good, thanks. George and Jeff, thanks for having me on again. It's always a pleasure being on the podcast.
There's this dead horse that we keep beating, but I figured we might as well talk about what stage that is in. So are we still talking about the fiduciary rule?
Sadly, yes. I can continue to give fiduciary rule updates. It seems as though this should have died a while back. But every week there's a new twist and turn. And setting the stage here, everybody knows, or hopefully you're aware, that on March 15th, the Fifth Circuit said, fiduciary rule, you're not any good. You're getting killed. Now, when it actually takes effect is when the Fifth Circuit issues this piece of paper called the mandate. Normally, totally non-controversial. 52 days later, where's the government agency it issues? So come May 7th, everyone's been asking, where's the mandate? And we found out what's going on yesterday. So California and New York and New Jersey, or Tom Park and Oregon, had moved to intervene and basically continue defending the fiduciary rule. The Fifth Circuit said, no, you can't. And then yesterday they said, well, I know you've already said, no, we can't, but would you mind reconsidering your decision? So now we're waiting for the panel that already said no to decide if they would like to reach a different conclusion. And it seems as though what the states are hoping is that they'll be given a chance to kind of appeal it again to the whole Fifth Circuit or appeal it again to the whole Supreme Court. It's pretty wild that we essentially have a non-party here, which is really keeping this case alive. With the SEC rule pending and with kind of everyone getting ready to transition away from the rule and the deal having already issued interim guidance, it's kind of an awkward situation where everyone's just waiting for this mandate.
And it seems like, but everybody's super patient these days, so I don't think that'll be an issue. Another week or two or month goes by, it's really not that big of a deal, right, Kevin? I guess it's going to have to be.
That's where it gets dicey. We're now not even arguing about the fiduciary rule, but the mandate's being delayed by essentially procedural questions. And there's always some chance that one of these procedural questions is interesting enough that either the en banc court or the Supreme Court chooses to hear that. In which case, even though it looks like the rule's dead on the kind of the actual legal analysis, this fight could take a while longer. So patience is a virtue.
Patience is a virtue.
I feel like this would be a really good reality show that we should possibly pitch to Netflix or Amazon. What do you guys think?
Couldn't be any worse than the proposed reality show with the Mooch and Stormy Daniels' lawyer.
Is that in the works?
I saw it on Twitter, so yes.
Wow. I should have been following that all week instead of these fiduciary rule updates.
Well, I mean, Kevin, from what I understand, you really love reading these updates. Why deprive yourself of such a compelling story?
Well, I mean, if it's the Mooch and Stormy Daniels, I mean, that's got to be compelling reading as well.
Yeah, I think so. Probably not almost as compelling as the Fifth Circuit. I mean, it's just amazing to me. I mean, if you're a plan sponsor, a record keeper, we talk about this. I feel like I'm beating my head against the wall. But, you know, if you're trying to do some planning here and you're just waiting and waiting and waiting. And meanwhile, we've got the SEC doing its thing in terms of best interest contract. I mean, at some point, we need some guidance from somewhere. Either we're going to have this or we're not going to have it. And it just feels like it's kind of lingering on.
At some point, we need certainty, and there's been a lot of clamor both on the industry side and on the kind of consumer group side for a best interest standard. And if the DOL standard isn't going to be that standard, then we need to start moving on to develop a different workable standard. And while this case is pending, I don't think we're going to get there. So more holding pattern, which is, I think each week I've given an update, and the conclusion has been stay tuned.
Yeah, we're going to have a holding pattern. We're going to run out of fuel in the holding pattern.
My grandpa used to say about his time in the Army, it's hurry up and wait. Hurry up and wait. So,
yeah.
Well, talking about slow stuff, what is this? What is going on with the Road to RESA?
So, as we've talked about other weeks, there's a bill in the Senate, the Retirement Enhancement and Savings Act, which is being championed by Orrin Hatch, who's retiring at the end of this term. And it's very similar to a bill from 2016 that passed the Senate with broad bipartisan support. Right now, it's having a little bit more trouble clearing the Senate. It still looks bipartisan, but there appears to be at least one senator putting a hold on it. But until now, the real message has been the House doesn't seem that interested. This week, the House, so the Subcommittee on Health, Employment, Labor, and Pensions, they had a hearing on four bipartisan bills, which contain components of RESA. So they looked at one bill that looks at creating a safe harbor in retirement plans for annuity options, a second bill that makes it easier to essentially use multiple employer plans, an open MEP bill, a third bill, which is designed to essentially index the amount that employers can cash out of their plans. So if, right now, if you have an account balance of less than $5,000 when a participant leaves, you can kind of roll them out. And then last, they were looking at a bill that would make electronic delivery of plan disclosures the default option. And all four of these ideas have fairly broad bipartisan support. That's not to say that there aren't opponents of each of these, but there are also things that have been in RESA. So the fact that the House is holding markups on bills and having hearings on bills that contain components of RESA would seem to indicate that the likelihood of the two chambers coming together and reaching a retirement deal sometime, probably late this year, are higher than they've been up until now.
Well, I think that's good. I mean, at least the chances are higher. I mean, we certainly need to, I from what I understood, retirement was like a bipartisan issue. And, when do we ever, are we ever going to get to a place, during the tax cut conversation where people were very concerned about, or people in Congress were concerned about the hit on the budget, right? The tax mm-hmm. deferral. And is that going to kind of swing back at some point, maybe not during the midterms, but, post-midterm, where we're going to start wrestling with that issue again? I mean, do we see that kind of bubbling up in conversation?
So, I'd be very surprised if ratification came back as a component of a standalone retirement legislation. Now, the problem that the retirement space has, the problem retirement savers have, is that ratification, the idea of moving essentially everybody from pre-tax dollars to post-tax dollars, it raises a ton of money. And the idea is out there. So I think when it scored during tax reform, it was something about $1 trillion over 10 years, or almost $1 trillion. And while for now there seems to be a bipartisan consensus that ratification isn't an attractive pay for, it's enough money that it's always going to stay in the conversation. And you could always see some situation where there's some priority that needs funding and they need $1 trillion because there aren't that many ways to get $1 trillion and it comes back into play.
Yeah, I guess it's going to be hanging out there.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Kevin. Fun plans for the weekend, sir?
My game plan is to play a little bit of golf this weekend.
Good.
It's been a busy week.
And, of course, watch the Royal Wedding.
Yeah, I mean,
and the Royal Wedding. I mean, I should have led with that.
Yeah, I mean,
as a huge Suits fan.
That's been a theme all show long. So the cost of the wedding was $45 million. Are we going to get up at 5 o'clock? Then we kind of pivoted to my wedding.
Yeah.
And then what about Preakness? Are you going to the Preakness tomorrow, Kevin?
Well, I didn't get invited to the Royal Wedding, so I had to find something else to do.
Okay, yeah. So you can see.
Preakness it is.
Freakness it is. I'll
so
see you in the infield.
It's on at 5 o'clock your time, which makes it 2 o'clock my time. So
you'll be up.
Yeah, I'll just stay up.
You'll be up watching something.
All right. Thanks a lot, Kevin.
Thanks, guys. Have a great week.
You too, man.
Bye.
Well, Jeff, another good show. Really strong and powerful guests helping out.
Yeah, I think we're doing what we set out to do at the beginning of the, launching the series, which is educate people about the issues. And, we try to do it in a way that's thoughtful. We can't explore every possible intimate detail in 10 minutes per segment, but we try to bring a broad range of subjects in front of everybody. People can certainly reach out to us and give us some feedback. We'd love to have that. But next week's shaping up to be a great show as well. We'll have our regular contributors back, but we're going to be visited by some other great guests. So we hope people enjoy and tune in, and most importantly, try to watch that Royal Wedding and check out the Preakness, and also listen to the podcast on Sunday.
I love it. All right, sir.
You have a great week, my friend.
You too,
and I'll talk to you next Friday.
Later.